The Ryan Tubridy Show on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Sky Broadband. With our broadband, your world is limitless. Live beyond.
Let me welcome our guest this morning, Anne Napolitano, to the studio. Good morning, Anne. Thank you for joining us today.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Hey, congratulations on Dear Edward. What a great book.
Thank you.
I mean, I'm not sure what it's going to do for flyers of the world or people who are nervous about playing, but we'll talk about that in just a moment. Just to, because you've written other books, but because this is the one that we want to talk to you about today, we just want to get a little feel for who you are, if you don't mind. And I'd like to go back to six-year-old Anne being dropped off to the library where you grew up, and give us a sense of what it's like to be that age, going through the doors. What section did you go for? What shelves were the magnets to young you?
Oh, I love that question. I get dropped off once a week, and actually I was such a serious reader that the librarians, normally there's a limit to how many books you can take out. It's like 10 or 15. Mm-hmm. And the librarian sized me up fairly quickly and told me I could take out as many as I wanted. So I used to bring a duffel bag to the library and fill it every week and bring them home and then bring it back the next Saturday. So I kind of read my way through the shelves without any knowledge of the sort of limitations of children's books or genre. Like, I read romance, I read westerns, I read, young horror books. I read everything.
Everything. And did you, I mean, at that young age, not just six, but as you got older again,
yes.
It's one thing reading books for your age or beyond, where you're just reading words and learning words and just thinking it's fascinating. But of course, you couldn't understand them because you wouldn't have the life experience in some respects for them. So, and then sometimes you can go back to a book 20 years later and read a totally different book.
Yes, 100%. I mean, I think that's true, you know, all the way through
your
20s. Yeah. I mean, if you read a book when you're 17 and read it again when you're 27, you're looking at it from a completely different viewpoint.
Yep.
But that's one of the wonderful things. Unless you read a book too young, like, it's entirely possible to read like a classic when you're 12 and not understand it and not like it. Mm. And then you put it aside and think you just don't like that book. But if you just waited a few years, it would have hit you better.
No doubt about it. So we've established your credentials, Anne, as a complete bookworm, which is the greatest thing in the world. Therefore, you're on our bus. Welcome aboard.
Thank you.
Let's talk then about you going into college. You were between 20 and 23. You were struck down by a virus called Epstein-Barr, which I'm not familiar with. Could you give us an idea of what that did to you?
Yeah, it's like, it's, I think you call part of it glandular fever.
Oh,
or
yeah, sure.
Mononucleosis. Like, it's a, so Epstein-Barr is kind of like the mothership of glandular fever. It's like the bigger version of that. So what it did basically was it wiped out my immune system so that I caught everything that went near me for like a year. And then I was sick for 3 years. So it took me an extra year to finish college. And it meant that I had like 3 hours of energy a day, as opposed to at that age, you're supposed to have like 37 hours of energy in a 24-hour day. So I kind of had to pretend to be a 20-year-old when I was around my friends. And then I would kind of like collapse onto my bed when I was alone. So it made me feel very like other for that period of time.
I appreciate that. And that actually will chime with with Edward. We'll get to that again in a short amount of time. But how often would you get food poisoning, for example, with that virus?
Like once a week. It was terrible.
Oh, come on.
That was probably the worst part. No, it was awful.
Once every 5 years is absolutely debilitating for most human beings.
Know.
But once a week?
I know. That was literally the worst part, because you just want to die when you have food poisoning.
Don't
so.
You?
Yeah, and it's so isolating. You're just alone in the middle of the night in the bathroom.
And what age did you feel as a 22 or 3-year-old when all around you were having fun and so on?
I felt like I was about 80. but it helped me figure out that like life was short in a way that I don't think you normally realize when you're 20. Mm-hmm. And it made me commit to, I'd always wanted to be a writer, but I think I don't know that I would have had the courage to actually do it if I hadn't gotten sick at that age.
What a weird and yet probably not uncommon way to realize it, you've only got one go at this.
Yeah, exactly. I was very aware after that, you know, I could be hit by the proverbial bus at any point.
So mortality, your own or others, is something that plays in your mind.
Yes, I mean, definitely. I mean, I think a recurring theme for me is how to live a meaningful life, and stories that circle around that subject are what pull to me most strongly.
You tried and failed to publish a couple of novels. You reckon you got about 80 rejections from agents and publishers over a decade. And then age 32, you sold your first novel. But I want to come to Dear Edward now, if I may, Anne, and ask you to explain to us, here we are in 2020, but I need to go back 10 years to a plane crash which left one Dutch boy as the sole survivor in real life. Why did that story affect you so much?
It obsessed me like immediately. I think the strongest image that I have for why it did so was that there was a picture of the little boy. So it was a very famous plane crash in 2010, and the flight was from South Africa bound for London, and it crashed in Libya, and the only survivor was a 9-year-old Dutch boy. And they found him still buckled into his plane seat about a half mile away from the rest of the wreckage. And he had a punctured lung and a broken leg, but he was otherwise fine. And everyone else in the flight, including his parents and brother, died immediately. And so it was obviously, it gripped everybody. It was massive news. But there was a photo of him in his hospital bed, and he was so beautiful and so small and broken looking. And I just kept looking at that image and how he was going to be able to climb out of that hospital bed and how he was going to walk out of that hospital without his parents and his brother. Like, how was he going to be okay? And I had two little boys at the time. They were 1 and 3. And that was certainly part of it, where I just felt like I needed that little boy to be okay. And I couldn't imagine how it would take place. So I ended up writing a set of fictional circumstances in which that could be the case.
Which brings us close enough to Dear Edward, I suppose, because you're right. That's what I so found so utterly absorbing about your book, where it's one chapter is about the flight, and you really brought us onto the plane, and the next was about something completely different, which is Edward trying to survive in a crazy world and process what happened. So your book, while it is all about a plane crash, is not about a plane crash at the same time, exactly the same time, two peculiar plates spinning.
Yeah, I mean, I think I would be reticent to read a book about a plane crash because I am a skittish flyer.
Well,
and
I find that bizarre that you would say that. We'll come to that in a minute. I'll let you finish the answer to this question before we get to that. Keep going.
Well, so I think I had to write a book that was about a plane crash that wasn't really about a plane crash.
And do you think you achieved that, Anne?
Well, I really don't think I'm the one to judge it, but people seem to feel that way, so I hope so, yes.
Okay, well, let's talk about the book then as a plot. Bring us on to the flight with Edward and his family, if you wouldn't mind.
Yeah, so the book starts with Edward and his brother Jordan and his parents boarding a flight in Newark, New Jersey. The flight is bound for Los Angeles, and his mother has gotten a new job in Los Angeles, so their family is actually relocating to the West Coast, so it's a big day and a big move. And we get to know several other people on the flight too. So there's a octogenarian billionaire. There's a soldier on his way back from Afghanistan. There's a Wall Street dude. There is a mathematician. There's a woman who believes in reincarnation. So there's a lot of people whose heads we dip into.
The air steward, all these lives that, you know, when I'm reading it, I'm thinking, God, I often wonder who you're sitting beside on a bus or, you know, on a plane. And why we are so complicated as human beings. We're complicated novels. So within the flight, you have a series of almost novellas.
Yeah, it was a lot of fun for me, actually, because everyone flies. So I got to go into the heads of these very different from each other human beings. And during a day that for them is more or less normal. They don't know that the plane is going to crash for most of the flight. So they're enmeshed in their own lives and their own concerns. And one of them's taking a pregnancy test and two of the others are flirting fairly extensively.
And the rest?
Yeah, and the rest, yes.
Mm-hmm. So when I say on the rest, you know what I mean? As a flirting continues apace. Yes, you do, because you wrote it. And then you've got what I think is so intriguing. At one stage, you talk about the wealthy guy, Cox, and mm-hmm. how he's just all about money. And I'm picking up my copy of the book that I kept a few stickers on it that of quotes that I liked. And this is a woebegone idea because the money, I'm quoting your book now, without him attached to it, has no meaning, just green and white paper rectangles that he spent his whole life, his whole self, socking away. And yet we know, because of the nature of the book, from the very first page, we know it's doomed. What was it all for?
Yeah.
Sense I mean, of that's. greed or something.
Yeah. I mean, it's like a mislived life in a certain sense, and him realizing it at the end of it. It was a lovely way to explore kind of like different ways to live life and different choices that are made and what the ramifications of that are. Not in a, hopefully not in a morally judgmental way. I love Crispin Cox.
Yeah.
But just in a way of like, we're so different from each other. We make such different choices, and how you feel at the end of that run is a reflection of the choices that you made.
As the flight starts to experience a little bit of trouble, you see sort of like little icicles building on a wing, and you might people might have seen such a thing. And in fairness, you keep it right till the end, so it's not, you know, it's the suspense is wonderful. And then the pilots are chatting away, and you just get this, because we know again that the flight's going down, but you get this sense of sickening doom, unavoidable. Did you speak to people in the aeronautical world, or your pilots or whoever, in terms of the black box transcript, where there's this awful realization between the two pilots that this is not rescuable?
Yeah, I mean, I extensively interviewed a career pilot, which was fascinating. And then I also read extensively like the National Transportation Safety Board reports, which include black box recordings from the flights that go down. And then there was one flight that I sort of used the reason that it crashed in the book, because it was very important to me not to sensationalize the crash. I wanted to make sure that it was accurate and felt true and felt real and solid.
Which it does.
And thank you. There was a flight, an Air France flight in 2009 from Rio de Janeiro bound for Paris, and it crashed into the ocean, and they didn't find the black box until 3 years later. And I sort of took the reasons for that crash and put it into my book.
I'm not sure if you're aware of this, but that flight you just mentioned has a really horrible association with this country, because three very young Irish doctors died on that flight.
I don't remember that.
Yeah, three, Doc Jane, DC, and Aisling Butler, and Ethna Walls, all graduated from medicine in Trinity in 2007 when we were returning home from holidays in Brazil. So I think it's, you know, thinking of their families today, actually, because Ireland is a small place, and it's difficult for families when you think of it. You just said in passing that you didn't want to sensationalize it, which I'm glad to say you didn't. I mean, I've never been in a plane crash, thank God, but you just seem to have, you know, when the plane does crash in this book, I didn't see a Hollywood blockbuster version of a plane crash in my head. I just saw a tragedy.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, that was really important to me. I wanted to take it seriously because it is such a serious thing. If I was going to step on that ground, I wanted to step on it with research and properly and respectfully as possible.
And even the passengers, there's compassion there. They mightn't be all lovable, but not everyone's very lovable in life. You know, all of certain assets or facets that aren't beautiful. But you seem to infuse them with the character. Did you look at other people you knew for that, or did you pluck them out of your literary sort of brain?
I actually did I spent the first year of the book taking notes and doing research and thinking about it. So I wanted the passengers on the plane to be very different from each other. And then I read research books in fleshing them out more. So Crispin Cox, I read the biography of Jack Welch, who ran the company GE for about 30 years.
Okay.
And he, Straight from the Gut is the name of that book. And he's very spunky and very enthused with his work. And that was really helpful. And then David Foster Wallace wrote a book about math that I read for the father, who's a mathematician.
Yes.
I read War by Sebastian Younger, which is a wonderful nonfiction book for the soldier. And also I have a friend who's in the military who I spoke to. And then I actually read Neil Gaiman's The Sandman series while I was in the first year. And that inspired Florida, because Gaiman is so wonderful about sort of joyfully dropping boundaries of space, time, and every other boundary that you can think of. And I was like, oh, you know, why can't one of the passengers believe that she's had many lives? So I tried to dive into them as deeply as I could in order to make sure that they worked as very different people from each other.
Is your book about kindness?
I hope so, actually. I think that what I realized while I was writing it was, in order to make sure that Edward was going to be okay in the way that I really wanted the Dutch boy to be okay, it was going to require a kind world. And I also think that when something terrible happens, it brings out the best in us. We step forward with kindness. If a child walked into the room you're in right now, like dripping wet and looking scared, you would immediately rush to him or her and see if you could help. It's like it's a natural response inside of us. So I got to see like a lot of beauty in the humanity around him in a way that hopefully isn't cheesy, but is true and within us all the time.
For sure. It's a lovely note on which to end our conversation. Congratulations, Anne, on a wonderful book. I look forward to your next one already, but it was great to talk to you. Appreciate your time this morning.
Thank you. I really appreciate you talking with me.
Not at all. It's Anne Napolitano, author of Dear Edward, which I'd be shocked if you didn't enjoy that, to be honest with you. And it would be a cracking book club read. But it doesn't have to be that. But one for the bag if you're on the bus or the train or whatever you might be. I've thoroughly, thoroughly enjoyed it. So I hope you quite like that. 51551 is the text number. Let's take a quick break. We'll come back for more after this.